Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, prison rights activist Sarah Short talks about her documentary End of Isolation, which is about a play she wrote on solitary confinement that she took on a 10-city U.S. tour. Then, Bay Area storyteller Ben Tucker shares his life story from Shreveport, Louisiana, to becoming a track star at San Jose State, and he has such an interesting life. We chat about that and other things from his memoir. Today's show is about finding freedom in our stories. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden, on KALW 91.7 FM. In the summer of 2022, anti-prison activist and playwright Sarah Short went on a 10-city tour with the cast from a play she created about solitary confinement in our prison system. During that tour, she met with prison rights activists who are making some changes in the to the prison systems in their area, and this is all featured in her documentary, The End of Isolation. Now, you may remember Sarah made news around the world in 2009 when she was captured by Iranian guards while hiking near a tourist site in northern Iraqi Kurdistan. Sarah was held as a political prisoner and spent 410 days in solitary confinement in an Iranian prison. That work has influenced her play, this film, the healing work she does, the multimedia work she does today. And she joins me in studio. Welcome, Sarah.
It's so good to be here.
I'm happy you're here. And this film, wow, it's so many emotions in this film.
Yes,
it gives you hope. It's heavy. It's real. So many emotions.
Exactly.
So So congratulations on the documentary.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you.
So I just want to give people just some data. So according to a study by the news site Solitary Watch, in 2019, more than 122,000 incarcerated people, including children, were held in some form of solitary confinement in this country. And in this documentary, Sarah, we see you and your castmates, because you all are taking the play The Box, which sold out when it debuted in San Francisco in 2016.
Yes.
10 years ago.
Yes.
Yeah, 10 years ago.
Yes.
So you all had this beautiful, bright colored school bus with this beautiful mural. And it was, you know, activists and actors. And you all hit 10 cities.
We did.
How was that for you?
Oh, it was, I mean, it was so many things. It was an amazing way to come out of the pandemic,
yeah.
You know? I mean, during the pandemic, I think a lot of people could relate more to the harm of isolation.
Okay.
Or, you know, the difference between solitude and isolation,
okay.
Right?
I thought about that, too, when I was, because I live by myself. And I'm an extrovert.
Okay.
And I thought about people. And I know it's not the same. But I did think about that when I was in quarantine.
But,
yeah.
Yeah. These are points of access, right?
Yeah.
To connect our humanity to the humanity of people locked up, mm-hmm. which during the pandemic, I couldn't not think about. I was so grateful to have my own cute little house and garden and everything. And I knew that I could go into this kind of like survival mode,
right.
And go back to a dark place. But I was like, you know what? That's not going to happen, because that's not where I'm at now.
Yeah.
And it ended up really being a breakthrough experience for me, the pandemic, of deepening my spirituality, connecting, you know, to just a bigger collective story,
wow.
Right, that we were in it together.
Yeah.
But yeah, we started to dream up the tour, the End of Isolation tour, during the pandemic, and the Pulitzer Center got behind it. So it was a struggle bus. It was a struggle summer. I mean,
it was literally a struggle. It was a pretty struggle bus, because it was colorful and outside.
It was gorgeous. It was beautiful. I mean, you know, transformation, healing. These are this is being in the struggle. This is being, it's like being in the mud, being in the and we were in it together. I mean, most of the actors, the majority formerly incarcerated on the bus. Mm-hmm. We drove through international heat wave.
I was thinking about that 100-year on their bus
storm in St. Louis. That was the only show that we didn't actually perform out of 27. We performed every show on time.
Okay.
To standing ovations. People, I mean, we often got multiple, one during intermission, one at the end.
Wow.
So it was like we kept getting the energy and like the juice back from the audience. Every time we stepped on the stage, it was like all the conflict, all the petty struggles around dishes. And I mean, this stuff is important, but it all dropped away. And we were just like so connected in the work. And everybody was so committed to making the work just live up to, you know, what it needed to be to honor the stories we were telling.
And the play is called The Box. And again, this film is about the box. What does the box mean? That title.
The box is another way to refer to solitary confinement.
Okay.
The box, the hole.
Okay.
Being locked in a cell for 23 hours a day.
Okay. And so I'm going to play a clip just to give people an idea of that play and how powerful it is. So in the beginning of the film, there's a dramatized reading of an essay written by someone incarcerated in solitary confinement. And these are stories and essays of real people that you all reenacted, dramatized, right?
Yeah. Initially, it started as letter correspondences that I did for several years and visited people in prisons. And that was my inspiration for writing the play.
Okay. Okay. So this essay that's dramatized is by someone named Jake Juchow. And so the actor reading it, is that your co-director, Bobby Field? Is that who that is?
Oh, no, that's not the actor.
That's not. Okay. That's not who. Okay. Who was it that read that?
John.
Okay, John. Okay. My apologies. All right. So it's a long clip. So let's play that clip. Play it.
Life in the Hole by Jake Juchow. Outside, the world lulls people to sleep. But in here, I work hard to stay awake. I once read 87 hours straight, only stopping to eat or take a leak. Books are my life. I have to hide them if I want to hold on to them. Under my pillow, inside my mattress. After they sent me down here, my remaining family stopped writing. And I have no friends left on the outside. I've adapted much better than most guys, but do you ever think about the importance of looking out a window? After 10 days, your neurons begin to shrink. You start seeing flashing lights, hearing voices and footsteps that aren't there. You want air, like a mosquito wants blood. You want touch. This life is the slowest way to die.
Wow. Woo, that's deep. That is deep. What does solitary confinement do to people mentally and physically? The toll it can take.
Yeah. As the actor, you know, John Neblett, just read that scene from The Box, describes the slow deterioration of your mental capacity. There's all kinds of scientific studies that have shown that solitary confinement attacks the frontal lobe, which is the part of our brains that help us make good decisions, that make us pro-social.
Yeah.
So solitary confinement slows down the brain. People have hallucinations, insomnia. Mm-hmm. It's like being a caged animal. I mean, you literally are a caged animal. So a lot of people end up pacing back and forth across their cell for years. I once saw a person's cell that where they had worn a groove in the concrete from pacing.
Wow. And, you know, you hear stories of people, they may have been in there for a day, they may have been in there for decades.
Exactly.
In solitary confinement. And then physically, I was reading that we need to move, you know, and that can affect you. And I know I used to work, we were talking about this earlier, I used to work in mental health advocacy, and your mental health affects your physical health, and your physical health can affect your mental health. So if you're not moving, that can also bring up health issues too as well. I was reading, I think it's Solitary Watch. That's what I was reading.
Yeah, totally. It compounds everything. It does exactly the opposite of what it's said, you know, meant to do, which is in some way rehabilitate people.
Yeah.
The The physical pain of isolation, the pain of isolation is like a physical pain. So people say, oh, solitary confinement, the UN says it's torture. It is definitely torture, but physical torture must be worse. But those of us who have experienced solitary confinement will tell you it's the same as physical pain. It's an excruciating anguish to be separated from everything that you love and not know if you'll ever get it back.
The film, one of the things that really caught my attention, well, a lot of things caught my attention in this film, but I was really interested in the history because I didn't know the history of where this comes from.
Yeah.
Can you break that down? Because I really was...
Absolutely.
Like, wow, when you broke that down in the film.
So the End of Isolation film, it's one of the first scenes takes place in the Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. That's one of the 10 cities we went to on the tour that you talked about. And we performed inside the jail, the Eastern State Penitentiary, where solitary confinement was first invented by...
Was it the Quakers? I was surprised when I read that.
Most people were shocked by that. They really thought that it was going to help people. They thought that removing people from the world, and they would put a hood over people's heads, would help remove them from the evil in the world, and they would find God. And the opposite happened. People self-mutilated, did everything they could to commit suicide.
Mm-hmm. And so then they shut it down, right?
The Quakers were like, that was a bad idea. Yeah. They learned from their mistakes. They actually apologized.
Oh, wow.
And it wasn't, and at the right around that same time, Charles Dickens spoke out against the practice. It wasn't a common practice in the U.S. until much later. Even the Supreme Court did a ruling. They didn't ban it, but they did a ruling.
That's interesting that it shut down and then the U.S. still kept going with it.
With the so-called war on crime, which was actually a war on poverty in black and brown poor communities, the rise of mass incarceration, prisons became overbloated. It became a control mechanism. You had to threaten people with torture, and really more than a control mechanism because of terrible conditions, also it was a way to suppress resistance. From the beginning in our prisons, resistance has been people standing up for their human rights. Mm-hmm. Prisoner rights are human rights. And the way to silence people is to send them to the hole.
Yeah.
So it's a mechanism clearly designed to keep mass incarceration growing.
And resistance is what inspired you to do this film.
Everything
and
I do.
Play. And it's everything you do.
That's what I wanted to say.
The California prison hunger strike. You said today's the anniversary of it. Mm-hmm. That was in 2013 for 2 months in the summer of 2013. About 29,000 California inmates refused to eat. They were protesting against solitary confinement and other inhumane conditions. And I read that this is the longest and largest hunger strike in the state. So how did that influence? Now, that influenced the box and...
That happened shortly, just a year and a half after I got out of prison. So for me to be able to throw a lot of my pain, to connect my healing to what was happening in my country, to people, to my neighbors, my incarcerated neighbors, was very empowering. I'm a movement person. I was born into the movement.
Okay. Because your mom's an activist.
My mom's an activist. I saw her leave my... abusive father when I was a kid, start a new life for us.
Wow.
So it was like from the beginning, it was like, yeah, we're fighters in my family. It's part of my, I believe it's part of my lineage, my Irish roots. but we are lovers and we're fighters. And so to be able to connect that to my struggle, to other struggles, has always been an impulse that I learned from my own mom and my own family. And the hunger strike, 13 years, that event influenced people and inspired people all across the country.
Yeah.
And the film, you talked about the film being about the tour of our play. That is the connective tissue.
Right.
But really, the film is about people across the country on the front lines that we went to the cities where change was happening.
Right. And somebody started, I said, I hadn't heard about this.
I like to say, we went where the juices, we went where things were like like exciting, yeah. right? And we wanted to use our art and add to that momentum. And we went to places like St. Louis where there's an epic battle to shut down a jail.
Yes.
And so the film is the face of a movement, right. you know, a lot. The same with my play. My work is never really the traditional protagonist, antagonist. I mean, the protagonist is the movement,
yeah.
right? The movement to reimagine justice outside of prisons and jails. The antagonist, clearly, the yes. prisons and jails. But it's not just one person making this change, right? And so the film has many faces. It has some stories that we really follow more closely. Mm-hmm. But we want to give people a taste of just like how rich and multifaceted this yeah. movement is.
Well, let me tell folks where they can see the film. All right. So if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Sarah Short, executive producer and director of the documentary The End of Isolation. The film is about a group of anti-prison activists who travel to 10 cities across the U.S. to perform a play about solitary confinement in our country's prison system. And the film features prison rights activists who are creating change in their communities, as she just said. And so, yeah. And so you can watch Sarah's film, The End of Isolation, during Brave Maker Film Fest in Redwood City, and it's happening on Sunday, July 12th. So yeah, I want to go back to these activists that you mentioned. We have about 10 minutes left. But definitely, Inez Bordeaux was part of the Close the Workhouse campaign in St. Louis.
Yes.
And this jail was a debtor's jail where most of those locked up were Black people. And the conditions were inhumane. And I was shocked because,
yeah,
spoiler, they shut it down.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why, I mean, I couldn't make a depressing film. In the times we're living through, like, I couldn't physically do it. And I also can't put that out there. We don't need more. Like, I needed to make a hopeful film. But it's hard to make a hopeful film about prisons because it's heavy stuff,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, stuff that I'm inspired by the resistance, but even with the resistance, it's still heavy for a lot of like my audience. Mm-hmm. But this film is for young people. I wanted young people to feel like change is possible.
Yeah.
And I feel like at a certain point, spirit touched this film. You know, I'm a spiritual person. Mm-hmm. And I think when you're in the flow of creativity, the hardest thing was figuring out how to end it with people feeling the gravity of the problem, how much work we have to do.
Yeah.
Because like prison system is the history of America, right? And the history of racial control. But the workhouse campaign, I was so grateful that we focused on that because it has, like you said, like the day that we got the call that they were sending bulldozers to tear it down, like literally
yeah.
raise it to the ground. I knew that was the ending for our film.
And that jail had existed for decades. It had existed for decades. And I was like, wow. And coming from California, I was like, a debtor's jail? That sounds so
archaic.
Yes, that's the word. Yeah.
Yeah.
Get out of my head, Sarah. That's exactly what I was thinking.
I mean, it is archaic. There's a lot of things about this country that are archaic, right. Unfortunately.
Yeah, when you go outside. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's stuff in California, but definitely especially when you go outside of California. I said, they have a debtor's jail? And then, like, people could walk down the street and see, because it was a heat wave, and, like, people, they were burning up. They were hot.
Yeah.
And so they would bring tubs of ice, but they would melt immediately because it was super, super. It was like 110 degrees or something in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And heat gets people going.
Mm-hmm.
And that led to some resistance. That was amazing.
I mean, just the fact alone that people like Inez Bordeaux can come out of the most inhumane, hopeless conditions mm-hmm. and come out with like vision and
yeah.
capacity to do something that is near impossible. I mean,
yeah.
like shut down a jail, like it doesn't happen. Like she says in the film, you'll see them shut down a jail when they absolutely have to, when it's like it's deemed, you know, inhabitable.
Right.
But then they'll build another one. And in St. Louis, that hasn't happened. So that is
right.
the true spirit of our movement is decarceration. We don't want to tinker around the edges. Even abolishing solitary confinement, of course we want that because solitary confinement is torture. But we have to make sure they don't put something else in its place. So when you decarcerate, that means there's less people in prisons and jails. That's progress. That means less people being tortured, less people being brutalized.
And there's also to a great activist, Kaleem Nazim, who's co-director of Decarcerate. And when you look at the spelling of it, the AR is capitalized because they're in Little Rock, Arkansas too as well. So he's doing work. I was shocked because he was put in solitary confinement because he wouldn't pick cotton.
He wouldn't pick cotton.
And I was, again, archaic, you know, what year are we living in? And just looking at the, you know, prison conditions in different parts of the country, but also too seeing how people are taking steps to make change was
exactly.
really just really, really interesting in a film.
And that's what's really important to me is that people understand, like, I mean, truth is a value I hold. I recently got feedback from a friend that I'm like relentless about my truth, telling the truth.
Okay.
And it's like, well, yeah, I am, you know?
Yeah.
But it's like, I don't want people to be depressed by it, but I want them to ground themselves in reality, mm-hmm. that our prisons are the way they are, not by neglect, not by mistake, but by design. They were meant to maintain the status quo of racial oppression in this country and to maintain a hierarchy of poverty and inequality. And they're still doing that job. They're not doing what they're telling us it's going to do. They're telling us they're making us safer, and they're not. And I'm not saying that people don't need to be taken out of society, that there shouldn't be consequences for harm.
Yeah, and that was my next question. Mm. I wanted to know, what was your vision? You know, if I can give you a magic wand, like, how would you envision the justice system when it comes to that? Because I'm sure there's some people listening who may have been victims of really, you know, horrible crimes.
Yeah.
And they're like...
Which I completely understand. That's happened in my own family.
Yeah.
And I would never get between someone saying that someone that hurt them should be put away and to be stopped from hurting someone else.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going to fix the root of the problem. Prisons have not made our society less violent. They've made our society more violent, piling trauma on trauma. So the vision is address the root causes, right? We don't pour fire on fire. We pour water, right? We uplift the people that are most poor, most desperate in our society, and we look at what are the root causes of crime. People that are trying to feed their children, you know?
Yeah.
People that are addicted to drugs. So you could cut our prison population in half overnight, and that would not be a problem. Half those people would never go back. They would never commit crime again. Satanya Emile DeWeaver, the listening guide of the film, says that, and I deeply believe that to be true. The other half, that's going to take some time. We're going to have to look at each person as a human, right, not a number, and figure out, why did you do this? Like, that's what restorative or transformative justice is. And that's a movement across this country, mm-hmm. looking at people as individuals. Why did you do this? Not just, you're a bad person, let's lock you away and throw away the key. Because the reality is that person is going to come back out into our streets. So how are we serving ourselves by not looking at their humanity?
Yeah, and then if you have a record, you can't get a job. And so people...
Vicious cycle.
Yes, it's a vicious cycle. Now, you were in the box, right?
Yeah, I acted.
Did
in
you
it.
Play? Was that you playing a prison guard?
Yeah, that was me.
Is that Sarah? What was that like for you?
I mean,
I was not expecting that.
We could only fit 8 people in the bus, so everybody had to play multiple hats, you know.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, I mean, it was exciting and interesting for me. Acting is a trip, you know. You really have to feel it. I've been close with a lot of actors because I've been, you know, co-directing, mm-hmm. and, you know, obviously as a playwright. But you can't just go up there and act angry. You have to be angry.
Yeah.
You know? And
yeah.
So you really have to tap in. So I have a lot of anger. I'm, you know, I've always had a lot of anger.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nice to let that anger out on stage.
Really?
Even
okay.
though I had to get over myself of feeling like terrible about being such a horrible woman, you know, but I also, the prison guard was, you know, she's just a horrible woman.
Right.
But I had to understand why she was that way,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And so I got into it.
Okay. Because I wonder, I said, how was she able to do that? I'm just thinking because your past experience.
I tapped into my anger. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And we have like about a minute and a half left, but I know we were talking earlier, you know, because of your history, that's what you're known as, right? Like when people meet you, they're like, oh, I know you from, I read that story.
Yeah.
The lady that was in Iran. Mm-hmm. But there's so much more to you, Sarah. So.
Yes, indeed.
I know there's other things in your life.
Things that bring me so much joy. Not that this brings me joy, too.
Okay. Yeah.
But go ahead,
because I was reading your bio. You do healing arts and spiritual practices. So
yeah, that's where I came from today.
What other stuff are you passionate about?
Yeah, I'm a somatic coach.
Okay.
So breakthrough coaching. I love working. I mean, I've been doing in the healing arts also my whole life. Mm-hmm. I started out as a massage practitioner. But now I work with people, a lot of artists, activists, women and queer people that are just like using their trauma to propel themselves into, you know, their best selves, yeah. right? Like really like transforming through the fire
yeah.
of what we've been through
yeah.
and creating amazing things, just following your longing.
Yeah.
So I really love coaching.
Well, Sarah, this really was, I was just really moved by the film. It was only an hour and I learned so much. Mm-hmm. And so
thank you
for braving that hot school bus, that hot pretty school bus.
Absolutely.
To go around the country and do this play. Are you going to bring the box back? Any chance?
Oh, you know, I got to keep it moving. I mean, you know, the film is now my focus. I have this wonderful group of interns right now that the whole focus, like what gets me out of bed with this is like the young people that need to see this film, right? That's the North Star and be inspired and know that change is possible. It's not inevitable, but like Inez's daughter says in the film, given we do the work, we can destroy these systems that are oppressing us. And when you watch the film, I hear people coming out and saying they just are washed over with the possibility and the hope of that. And that's what I want young people to feel. So we're trying to get this into colleges. We want to do a college tour.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, good luck with that, because it's definitely very educational, too. Yeah. And entertaining in a good way. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, yeah. In a good way, in a lightning way.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sarah Shore's documentary is called The End of Isolation, and you can watch it during Brave Maker Film Festival in Redwood City, and that's happening on Sunday, July 12th. I can't believe it's July already. Coming up, a Bay Area man who uplifts people with his gift of storytelling, and he has such an interesting life. Stay with us. You're listening to the Sights and Sounds show with me, Janae Darden, on KALW 91.7 FM, and we dancing in the studio. Have you ever had a relative that you couldn't wait to sit by during a family function because they always have good stories to tell? Well, Ben Tucker, that is that kind of guy. He was part of the great migration of African Americans to the West. He was an All-American track star back in the 1960s when he ran for San Jose State, a preschool teacher in Berkeley, a social worker in Harlem, a track coach in Nigeria. Ben has done so much, and he writes about his life in his memoir, A Good Run. Now, Ben performs storytelling, but he doesn't just talk about himself. So you can watch Ben Tucker deliver his storytelling magic in person at the San Francisco Free Folk Festival on Saturday, July 11th at Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. And Ben joins me in studio as well. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Janae.
So good to see you. It's funny. People have been telling me to talk to you, and I'm glad we made it happen. And we met at the Black History event at the Chase Center earlier this year, so I'm glad we were able to connect. So, and I've seen you perform, and I've enjoyed your storytelling. What led you to becoming a storyteller?
It's very interesting. You know, my folks were always great storytellers. Yeah. My father, grandfather, my uncle, and I love sitting down, listening to them talk at family reunions and during the holidays and the whole bit. And so I was like an old soul hanging out with the old folks and listening to their stories. And so when I retired in 2003, mm-hmm. a friend of mine told me about this performing arts program called Stage Bridge for seniors.
Yes.
And I got involved with theater and then eventually storytelling.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I like about your story is that you try so many things. Like, you're doing storytelling, doing theater, running. What gives you the courage to just try?
Well, it all comes back to when I grew up. I grew up in San Francisco.
Right.
Just on the other side of the freeway over there. So coming over here is like homecoming.
Yeah.
and always wanted to belong just like anybody else, trying to find my affinity group. And so I tried a little this, tried a little that, and then I finally found my niche when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be a basketball player. I only had one problem. I couldn't play basketball.
That's a big problem, Ben.
That's a big problem, big problem. And so I got cut from the team. But what I really wanted was I wanted to be a letterman. I went to Polytechnic High School, okay, right across the street from the Golden Gate Park. And when I got called into the coach's office and he says, Ben, I'm going to have to cut you from the team. Oh, it was like a blow. Yeah. And I was so sad.
You also, too, I read in your book, you were trying to get girls. That was another reason why.
Yeah. Why else you want to be a letterman? You know, you got to be the big man on campus, be popular with the ladies, and all of that good stuff. But the other thing that happened, though, all of my friends were on the basketball team, and we're all black, came from the hood, Bayview. And when I got cut from the team, I was separated from my group. But the coach told me, he said, Ben, you're not a basketball player, but you are a runner. And I said, really? He said, yeah, I see you running up and down the court and around the Golden Gate Park. You can run cross country. I said, what's that, coach? I was a city kid. He said, we run through over hills and over dales and up and down. I said, oh, I can do that. I'm from San Francisco. I walk up and down these hills.
Yes.
So I tried out for a team that I didn't know anything about, cross country. And much to my shock and dismay, when I showed up for practice, everybody on the team were little skinny white guys.
Okay.
And so I'm out of my comfort zone. And so that told me that if I wanted to be, to get to where I wanted to be, I had to get out of my comfort zone. And that's what I did.
And then you went on. That's amazing that you didn't know how fast you were until high school, and then you end up, you got a full ride to San Jose State University.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And then you became this track star. Like, what was that like? I mean, especially this was in the early 1960s. And I remember just hearing from my parents. Back, well, they were at San Jose State in the 70s. It was farm country. That's what my mom
always says.
It was farm country.
That's right.
So what was it like for you to go from San Francisco, you know, the city, to San Jose, and to, like, just blow up and be this track star?
Yeah, even though, you know, San Jose was only like 49, 50 miles away from San Francisco,
right. It
was a whole different world.
Yeah.
We called it cowboy country because it was mostly farm.
Yeah.
And it was a tough transition. But one of the things that was really good is our track coach, Bud Winters, he recruited some of the finest African-American athletes, not only from California, but from around the world.
Mm-hmm.
We had athletes from Australia. We had athletes from Nigeria. We had athletes from Venezuela.
Wow.
And that core group of black athletes on that campus, we all hung together, and we had no EOP, no equal opportunity. But 99% of our athletes, student athletes, and that's what we were, student athletes, we graduated only because of that cohesiveness within that college campus, because there was nothing else for us outside.
Yeah. But you got off that campus because you made All-American in your sophomore year, right?
All-American in my junior year.
Junior year
and my senior year. All-American in track and field and in cross country. And we were two-time NC2A back-to-back champions in cross country.
And you competed around the country.
Around the country and around the world.
Yes. It took you to Europe.
Took me to Europe.
What, I mean, you know, because you're born in Shreveport. Like I said, you were part of the Great Migration. And then you were the first in your family to fly on a plane?
First what?
First in your family to fly on an airplane?
My first in my family to fly on an airplane.
Wow.
Yes.
What did, you know, running track and being so much exposed to the world when you know, when your family comes from a small town in Louisiana? I mean, they migrated to San Francisco, but still come from a small, you know, your roots are from a small town in Louisiana. How did you see the world when you kind of got out of your bubble and was, you were, I mean, you were like flying, right? Like, you were so fast, too.
It was amazing. But, you know, my parents really grounded me. Mm-hmm. And they made me feel, and all my extended relatives, like I was somebody.
Yeah.
You know, we came from real good, solid roots in Louisiana. We had, you know, core beliefs. And my mother was a real activist. You know, she wanted to be a school teacher, but she couldn't go to school beyond high school. And she instilled a lot of self-worth in us. And so I had a lot of self-confidence. I wasn't cocky, but I was sure that, you know, I could hang, and there was a big world out there, and I saw it. It was just like seeing that bite, and I said, I'm going to take a bite of this apple, and I'm going to get all that I can out of it. And I saw opportunities, and my parents always told me that prepare yourself, and when opportunity comes, you'll be ready to take advantage of it.
One of the things I like about your book, A Good Run, is there's so much family history. You know so much family, which a lot of people don't. I mean, you can go back to your great-great-grandparents, and a lot of people can't do that. So, and I know this is not my family, but I was interested. I was like, this is so interesting. I was just digging into it. Now, you're one of six.
Six.
Okay, you're one of six. Okay, and so this was very interesting. Your great-great-grandfather, John F. Herden, was a white man, and he was in a common-law marriage with your great-great-grandmother, and her name was Lou Patsy Charles.
Okay. Correct.
Okay. So she was enslaved, but he freed her, but they still, you know, she still lived on his plantation. He had other people enslaved. But Lou and John had two children, and they migrated from Virginia to Louisiana. That's so much American history. When you discovered that, what went through your mind?
Well,
because those are the kind of stories people try and hide.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Well, when I'd always heard, you know, that there were white folks in the family. I mean, our family goes from blue-black to, you know, blonde, blue eyes. Yeah. You know, they could pass.
Right.
In fact, some of them did pass.
Mm.
So we always knew it. But then my brother did a lot of digging. He found pictures. He went to the different census bureaus and actually saw a picture of John Herndon Franklin.
Wow.
And his middle name is Frederick.
Okay.
And so is my middle name, Frederick, too.
Wow.
And I'm thinking to myself, why on earth would my grandmother, name me after a slaveholder?
Okay.
But he did have 6 to 9 kids with my great-great-grandma.
Okay.
And when each of them were born, he did free them.
Okay.
But he did keep at least around 200 of those other slaves.
Wow.
Enslaved. He did not free them.
200?
He only freed them upon his death. That was part of his will that he left. He said, upon my death, free all of my slaves. And the other thing he did was he did found the first black elementary school in Cato Parish.
Wait, the white guy?
Yes. My grandpa.
Wow.
My grandpa, the white guy.
Okay,
great-great-grandpa.
Wow, yes. He founded.
So, you know, it was really something. And when I was doing the research, I was talking to a couple of friends of mine who happened to be white.
Yeah.
And they said, yeah, Ben, he was a slaveholder, but he was a benevolent slaveholder. And I say, that's an oxymoron. Mm. How can you be benevolent and be a slaveholder, okay? So I still am kind of conflicted about old John Herndon. But at the same time, I think he was pretty good to my grandma. And he left 150 acres that he passed on to my grandmother, my great-great-grandmother. And we passed it on down, and we still have that land in our family to this day. And we're fighting to hold on to it. Because, as you know, air property is some of the most vulnerable property.
Oh, yeah.
And the buzzards are circling, and they've been trying to get that land back. But our family is working. Now we're developing a limited liability corporation to make sure that we can't get any of that land picked off by the land folks that are trying to look for oil and other minerals on that land.
And this is in northern Louisiana, right? Like near Shreveport.
It's right out, a little small town right outside of Shreveport, about 50 miles.
Okay. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with storyteller and author Ben Tucker. His memoir is A Good Run, and he takes readers from Louisiana to San Francisco to San Jose State, where he was an All-American track and field star, to the Civil Rights Movement and Vietnam War, Europe. He's been everywhere. Ben has such an interesting life, and his book is available on Amazon and books and at Books, Inc. in Alameda. You can hear Ben Tucker do live storytelling at the San Francisco Free Folk Festival on Saturday, July 11th at Golden Gate Park in, of course, San Francisco. So let the folks hear what you can do. You got a story for me? I know you got plenty of stories for me.
I got tons of stories. But I got a story especially for you, Janine, because when you called and gave me the directions, you told me, oh, Mr. Tucker, how are you going to get here? You're going to drive? I said, no, I love public transportation.
Right.
And she says, well, you can take public transportation, but you better take an Uber because our studio sits on a steep hill. And I said, I'm going to take public transportation.
Yes, you did.
And so, having said that, I said, I've got a story that I'm going to talk about.
All right.
Why I can do this. And it's called The Hills That Raised Me. I grew up at the top of a hill on Topeka Street. And it's between Apollo and Venus. That should tell you a little something. It connotes heights. Mm-hmm. And whenever I left home, was to go to school or go down the hill to get something from the grocery store, I had to go down a hill or go up a hill. There was no getting around it. To go to school, I had to get up, go down, up, down, up. And little did I know that those hills were actually making me a lot stronger. I was only 8 years old. So I had a paper route, and I had an old raggedy bike, and I used to have to pedal that bike up, no gears, none of that stuff. And so basically, I didn't realize I was really, really building character. But here's the twist. Those hills, much to my knowledge that I didn't have, was turning me into a runner, a world-class runner. While other kids were rolling around, you know, in the streets and the flats and everything, I was training. Now, the hills didn't really care if I was tired. They didn't care if I was small. They didn't care if my bike was held together with ropes and clothespins. The hills just said, climb, climb if you want to get to your destination. Now, years later, when I got into running, racing, and everything, and I ran into that first hill, everybody slowed down. I speeded up because compared to that hill was nothing compared to my childhood. Now, this is what it's like, I said to myself when I was going up that hill in that race. I said, I feel like I'm back in the hood. Now, today, I'm 83 years old. I'm headed to a radio station on top of the hill, Burden High School. And so I get off the BART, I don't take the Uber, and I'm out here reenacting my childhood at 83, coming up that long slope. And the hills to me is the same thing as altitude is for the Kenyan runners. They have that natural built-in because of their environment. And so, the hills of San Francisco, they are in my DNA. Now, San Francisco didn't just give me a neighborhood with the best weather and the best views. It gave me grit. It gave me endurance. It gave me legs that had carried me for 83 years. And you know what? I'm still climbing, and they still carrying me. Now, every hill taught me something. Don't fear the climb. Don't quit halfway, and never, ever stop reaching for that next view. As long as I could put one foot in front of the other, I'm going to keep on moving upward, upward and over. So, if you remember anything from my story today, remember this. Keep climbing. Keep growing. Keep believing. Because the best view always comes after the hardest hill. And as Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell said, ain't no mountain high enough.
Hey.
Ain't no valley low enough to keep me from my view. Woo-hoo. Because the view isn't just at the top of the hill. It's found in a life lived with courage, hope, and perseverance. At 83 years old, I'm still climbing. And I hope all of you out there in radio land will be doing the same thing when you get to that age in life. So keep on keeping on.
Clap, 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 clap. Ben Tucker, I love your stories. Wow. At 83, and you hike. And you still hike, because you hike, we were talking about this earlier, you hike 8 miles once a week.
Every Monday morning.
At 83. You still moving.
Still traveling. Still traveling.
Wow. Amazing, amazing, amazing. Like I said, you just have such an interesting story. And we have a few minutes. You know, and I have so many questions I want to ask you, but much of your work is in service. Or, you know, when you were working, was in service to the community. You were a preschool teacher, a social worker, a recruiter at Cal, administrator at Cal. You were a leader at Head Start.
Yes.
Yeah.
One of the first inaugural programs, Head Start San Francisco, Western Edition, and in the city of Berkeley.
Yes, yes, yes. You're from San Francisco, grew up in Bayview, Hunters Point, but also to live most of your life in the East Bay. You know, you've helped people, and you worked at the San Francisco Zen Center. You've been to so many different places, Urban League when you were in New York. Where did you get the passion for service? Because that definitely came across in your book. You were passionate about service. You were passionate about the community.
Got it from my mom.
Okay.
Like I said earlier, my mom wanted to be a school teacher. She wasn't able to go to college because of Jim Crow in the South. But she always encouraged us to go for education, but also not for the money, but to go for the service. You know, my mom was a PTA leader. I didn't particularly like that because she was always up at the school and everybody thought I was in trouble. Oh, your mama's here. You must be in trouble. And she also was in the voter registration. We always had the polling booth in our basement. She was big in the church, you know, senior center. She'd go down to City Hall and lobby for this and that. And so she said, if you want things to get better, you gotta make it better. Yeah. Don't just sit and complain. Get involved and do.
Okay. Yeah, because that was so many things, you know, came to me when I was reading your book. And speaking of service, I'm thinking of the service, because definitely something else that was very interesting in your book was Vietnam. Vietnam, you were just graduating out of college, right, when Vietnam War started. And they were drafting folks.
Left and right.
And you got a one-way ticket?
Got a one-way ticket to Europe.
To Europe.
I became a draft dodger.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so what happened? We got 3 minutes.
Okay, What happened? I do the three-minute drill. What happened was I tried to be a conscience objector. I wrote all kinds of passionate pleas while I was against the war, and I got turned down. And basically one guy said, hey, we don't care about that. We just need some bodies.
Right.
And so when they told me that they were going to draft me and my buddy Ernie Kelly, we hitchhiked across America, went to New York, and took a trip to Sweden where they had help for those folks who were resisting the draft. Now, I was over there for about a year, bounced around, but I got homesick. I got tired of that European cuisine. I missed some of that good soul food. And the winters were so cold in Sweden. Yeah. Came back, and I was indicted.
Right, by the U.S. government.
I was indicted, and I was at the courthouse down on Golden Gate, and I stood before the judge, and I had a wonderful lawyer by the name of Audrey Grossman, and he got me off on a technicality because I never received my final draft notice. And so I beat the rap because of that, and I was able to, but I very well could have gone to jail. When I was standing in that court, they took a lot of people out that back door. They came in through the front, they went out through the back, but I was able to beat the draft thanks to the Draft Counseling Center in this good old city of Berkeley, and I got a pro bono lawyer, and I beat the rap. And that was a courageous stand, the most courageous stand I ever took in my life. Mm. And I did it because of Muhammad Ali, because Ali was also indicted and around the same time. And I said, if Ali can do it, so can I. So all praises to that great boxer and activist, Ali. He was my hero, even though we were around the same age.
Wow, okay. Yeah, because when I read that, I said, what? Like, I mean, but you know, people had to do what they had to do to survive. Okay, real quick, 30 seconds. You're in your 80s, you're 83. What is one of the greatest lessons you've learned?
The greatest lesson I've learned in life, and I've learned many of them, is the thing is adversity will strike, and adversity is always there. We have to learn how to deal with adversity and turn lemons into lemonades. And I've always been able to see that little silver lining. And just like where we're in these times now, we're going to get through these folks. We've been here already. And as, what's my man's name? We're going to be all right.
Kendrick Lamar.
We're going to be all right, folks. Let's just keep on keeping on.
Yeah, because you've seen a whole lot.
Yes.
So I'm going to take your word for that. Ben Tucker, I'm so happy we got to meet and we got to connect. This is a great book, I think. You know, I know definitely for your family, but just for people in the Bay Area, it's a really, really good book. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Ben Tucker is a storyteller. His memoir is A Good Run, and you can get his book on Amazon and at Books, Inc. in Alameda. And make sure you check him out at the San Francisco Free Folk Festival on Saturday, July 11th at Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. That's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darton. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rango, and board operator, Tariq Ansari. And thank you for tuning in, because I know the World Cup game is about to come on, so thanks for hanging in with us. And I just want to send some love and light to actor Danny Glover. People Magazine released a feature story this morning announcing that he is living with Alzheimer's. So just sending him lots of love and light, and also to his family and loved ones. We'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. Until then, be good to yourselves and each other. And also, too, make sure that you follow us on Instagram. I'm at Janae.Dart on Instagram, because we post announcements and videos related to the show. So make sure you check us out there. All right. You all have a great afternoon.